Welcome to the Accelerators Podcast. We're bringing you oncology news and views with guests from all over the field. The discussions on this show are not medical advice, and they represent our own opinions and not those of our employers. The Accelerators is part of the Photon Media family of podcasts. You can check out all of our shows at photonmedia.org.
Hello, everybody. This is Semel Parikh, radiation oncologist, medical director at Lake Huron Medical Center in Port Huron, Michigan.
And I am Matt Spraker, radiation oncologist coming from Denver, Colorado.
And I'm Dave Chang, radiation oncology medical director in Lake Charles, Louisiana.
Really happy to have you on. Followed you on Twitter. I like what you say. I'll tell you what started me to become a fan of Dave Chang was that we were both Andrew Yang supporters. Nice. For a time, and yeah. In general, that style of politics was appealing to both of us, and I think we've had some conversations in the past about that. And so, other than that, I think we share that we're both small market rad oncs. We face similar challenges, and we find ourselves on the same side of a lot of these large questions affecting our field. And so we thought it'd be great to have you on here and kind of talk about those things and also kind of ask for some help, because I think we have some limitations. We have some strengths, but we have some limitations that keep us from performing at the highest level possible. And it would be great if the larger world of radiation oncology can kind of see what we do, what we face, and why our patients are just as valuable as those in fancy zip codes in Manhattan. Yep. So Dave, tell us where you're from. Where'd you grow up?
Yeah. So, you know, I kind of grew up all over the Midwest. My mom was a radiation oncologist herself. And like many rad oncs, she, you know, moved between different cancer centers. So she knows quite a bit about small market practice as well, because she's been in places as small as Portsmouth, Ohio, which is really in the middle. So we moved around the Midwest, you know, Indiana, Ohio, and Pennsylvania when I was growing up. The one place I probably spent the most years of my life was Indianapolis. So that's a pretty big city.
That Portsmouth job keeps popping up. Quite a small town in Ohio, and
oh, yeah.
The ad, it offers unheard of riches.
Probably so. I don't know. But yeah, you know, so I did my undergrad education up at Purdue University and medical school at the University of Louisville, so all close by in the Midwest, and then wound up going back to Indianapolis for my residency at Indiana University. It was kind of interesting. The first day that I got there, they showed me the residence room, and one of the old physicists that had been there since my mom was a resident there pulled out a big, you know, photo album from the back, full of photos from, you know, years and years ago. And there I was as a little munchkin, like a, you know, 6-year-old running around the same room that now I had a desk as a PGY2.
That's awesome. That's awesome that you and your mom could share that experience. Is she still practicing or is she retired?
She is retired. You know, she had sort of gone semi-retired maybe 10 years ago and just, you know, locumed all around the U.S., and then at some point she declared she was fully retired, which means she still locums, but only for like 2 weeks out of the year.
That's so cool overall. I went to Indiana University for undergrad. So it has a special place in my heart there. And don't hold it against me being a Purdue grad that I went to IU. But it was cool because when I entered the field, like, you know, that place has so much history in radiation oncology. You know, Indiana's like, you know, the birthplace, I guess, of SBRT, maybe, so to speak. And so, you know, this is just adding more to that. So there's a lot of history there. It's really cool.
Yeah. So, you know, when I was graduating from residency back in 2013, you know, I'd interviewed at a variety of places, and my main criterion was actually trying to get somewhere with warmer weather. Because the whole time that me and my brother were growing up, you know, every winter we were in the Midwest, so it'd get cold, it would snow. And every time it snowed, my parents would be so upset. They'd be like, we're Taiwanese people. We're tropical people. Why are we living in this weather? So wouldn't you know it, over time, my parents made their way down to Central Florida. My brother made his way down to Central Florida. And now I'm here in Louisiana. You know, when the job opened up and I interviewed here, it was honestly not so much, definitely not the location. I'd never been to Louisiana before other than, you know, visiting the Superdome once. And I knew absolutely nothing about Southwest Louisiana. But it was actually the core group of people that were working here, most of whom are still here today. You know, they had kind of built a very tightly knit family of, you know, a receptionist that had been there since before I was born, a chief therapist that had been there for over 20 years at the time, now over 30 years, and then their dosimetrist, their, you know, other therapists, the nurse, you know, even their administrator, you know, overseeing that department, were all people that had sort of grown up together, gone to school together, and everybody worked really well. And, you know, that can be a risk. You know, some places you have inbreeding and people are like a clique, and when you're an outsider, you don't belong. But in their case, there was this feeling that everybody was a family that was very, very comfortable with working with each other and made things work, you know.
Yeah.
Smaller department, you run into a lot of little resource limitations and a lot of hitches. And if people aren't willing to cover each other, you know, some of the time, sometimes step outside your formal job description, you know, things would grind to a halt pretty quick.
Yeah, I hear you. I think for us in these types of jobs, the number one thing is what you mentioned. How well does the staff get along with each other and with the doc that's been there in the past? Very similar. I mean, I grew up 50 miles away from here, but it's a kind of a place where people move to as they grow older. And three of the radiation therapists went to the same high school I did. And, you know, we've had staff that have been here. My manager's been here 33 years. And as you're saying, we have two jobs. So my manager is also the dosimetrist, and the radiation therapists have been there for 30 years plus. We're finally having some changes. We, you know, our front desk person's been at the hospital for almost 20 years. It's a very similar feel, like where it feels like family, where we take care of each other and we really try to understand everybody's limitations, because we simply don't have the resources that many other places do. You kind of want to talk about that a little bit, about resource limitations?
Can I ask you quick first before we do that? I just wanted to ask really quickly. So that's a really cool thing about those departments. Do either of you feel like it was a challenge to come in as an outsider? And Dave, for you especially, it was your first job, right? And so I think you gain a little bit of knowledge as you go on about starting a new job and how to like enter a department well. But for you specifically, you know, given that it was a very tight knit kind of small community in the department, do you feel like that was a challenge, or was it not really a big deal? And
well, it's interesting, right? Because when you practice in a smaller town, in a smaller hospital, where almost all the staff are like these people who have been, you know, friends since they were in kindergarten, they're kind of used to the idea that physicians, you know, are almost like space aliens or foreigners, right? You know, there's not enough people from small town Louisiana that actually go to medical school and become MDs. So while there are, you know, plenty of MDs who did grow up here, you know, the majority of MDs are from somewhere outside, a lot of them from, you know, outside the country, FMGs. And so, you know, I think the staff expects that the physician's not going to be exactly the same as them, right? You know, I don't go to all of their church functions. I'm agnostic. You know, and I don't go to a lot of the same social circles, you know, that a large amount of the staff goes to. But when it comes to work, I actually found it surprisingly easy to sort of integrate and get into the workflow, get into the vibe of things.
That's good. I think, yeah, that's good to hear. I think that's probably something that people maybe don't think about as much that could be a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. I mean, We're kind of growing up. We grew up in metropolitan areas, or most of the time, or educated metropolitan. Maybe we don't hunt or fish, but you know, when a patient brings me venison or walleye, I take it graciously. And I think that's kind of a neat part of this community. These types of communities is that they thank you in very special ways. And
it's true, you know, in a smaller town where you're seeing lots of truly rural patients, you do get gifted a whole lot more fruits, vegetables, you know, deer sausage and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The good stuff. Yeah.
The good stuff. Yeah. And I think I think that it's important. Like you said, we're not going to share all the same activities, but the doc here before me treated them like family, and that needed to continue for the staff to be happy. Like, I think we'd be fine without it, but you know, within months of having started the job, you know, I invited the staff to my house for my kid's birthday. They come to our events and stuff like that. Not everything, and they don't always show up, but they know they're invited. And that's part of being in this community. I may not live here, but they're my work family, and we share a lot of time together, which is great.
For sure. So, you know, I think, Matt, you had mentioned, you know, the idea of resource limitations, and all of us, anyone who's ever practiced in a smaller area knows that it's not the same as practicing in a big city, because you just can't take for granted that all the consultants and all of the, you know, auxiliary services that you would be at your beck and call in a larger center, it might not be there. You know, my center, the biggest crisis we're going through right now is that our hospital does not have a full-time interventional radiologist. They're actively trying to fix that problem, but for the past about 8 or 9 months, we haven't had one. And so that means that, you know, all of us have seen the very stereotypical picture of the stage 4 small cell lung cancer patient who shows up with a ton of tumor in their chest, a ton of tumor in their neck. And if there's an IR on staff, you know, and they haven't seen a doctor in 30 years, obviously don't have a diagnosis. If there's an IR on staff, they biopsy that supraclav node the same day and you have a diagnosis and you can go ahead and you can start treating them. When you're at a center that where the interventional radiologist isn't coming until next week, then you're in a bit of a bind. And so you have to get used to dealing with those situations, you know, to weighing, you know, the pros and cons of when are you willing to treat without tissue? In my case, extremely, extremely rarely. If they're that emergent, you know, they probably need to be transferred to a bigger center, but it can happen. And you also have to deal with, you know, things like endoscopic ultrasound, all of your esophaguses, all of your rectums. You know, I don't know what the total number of EUS, you know, equipment in the United States is, but it's not a very big number. So if you're in any city, you know, that's smaller than about 150,000 people, you're not going to have one. And the closest scope that can do an EUS is going to be an hour and a half away. And so which patients actually need that EUS for staging? And then which patients are you just going to stage based on imaging and, you know, traditional endoscopy, you know, and treat quote unquote empirically? That's a decision that you have to make, because if you follow the NCCN guidelines strictly and say, well, I need endoscopic, you know, ultrasound staging on absolutely everyone, then you're going to end up delaying a lot of patients' treatment. And some of your poorer patients who are transportation limited, might not have perfect mental status, they might get lost to follow up entirely.
Yeah, I mean, treating without tissue, when I got here, looking back at the follow-up patients, close to 70 or 80% of the stage one lung patients were treated without biopsy.
Really? Oh, wow. Okay.
And I've surveyed around in small towns, it's not uncommon to have that high of a rate. And that was something we wanted to change. But, you know, this morning you get a guy, doc, if you think it's cancer, I don't want to go through that. And you know, we do what we can and we do the best for our patients, and we don't want to mistreat or treat a granuloma, but
right.
What do you do?
It's a judgment call. Yeah. And I've had exactly that same experience as you. And I really do try not to treat without tissue, but in patients where there's a high chance that it is malignant and, you know, the patient isn't going to drive an hour and a half to get a biopsy, you know, or they're very frail and the biopsy might, you know, be risky, sometimes we treat without tissue. You know, it's just, and you always want to try to produce some kind of supporting evidence, some kind of supporting rationale, you know, not just the patient history, but I know I don't have the exact paper saved on my home computer, but on my work computer, somebody published a paper, I forget which one of the big medical centers, with a like a nomogram or what's the percent chance of malignancy for a lung mass based on its radiographic characteristics. So I like to use things like that, even knowing it's not validated, it's not going to be a very accurate predictor, but something is better than nothing, you know, when you're stuck with nothing.
Exactly. I mean, that's it. I use that Mayo Clinic calculator all the time.
Yes, that's right. It was Mayo. Yeah.
And this morning, you know, it comes at 92%. It's like, well, yeah.
Well,
I don't know. I mean, I think it's okay to go ahead and treat, and patient agreed. So we're going to move forward. Now, we've talked a little bit online, and you mentioned when I messaged you about maldistribution. And I think we've touched around that subject on the show, but it'd be nice to kind of get an idea and discuss this a little further. About this problem. And I'd love to get your take on it.
Absolutely. And boy, do I have a take. So, you know, maldistribution and this quote unquote urban rural divide is something that so many people talk about. You know, if you only listen to, you know, Astro or something, it's a whole bunch of people who have never really practiced in small towns trying to comment about us. But when you actually look at small town practice, first of all, my biggest pet peeve of a lot of the discussion regarding smaller radiation centers is when people call us rural radiation oncology, because we're not. There's no such thing as a LINAC that's in the middle of a cornfield. We're all going to be in cities. It's just that we're in smaller cities. And, you know, as a point of comparison, my wife, Claire, you know, grew up in Plocheville, Louisiana. That is a town with a population of 200 something. It has one store, one restaurant, two streets, and no traffic lights. When Claire moved to Lake Charles, it was because she was moving to the big city. You know, so at a population of 85,000, we're actually the sixth biggest city in the state of Louisiana. We are not a rural census tract. We are not a rural location. We're a city. Our five parish area has a population of nearly 300,000. And so as a city, we have multiple art walks a year where Claire sells her art. You know, we have multiple food and wine festivals, a rum festival, a whiskey festival. We have a music festival and a freaking anime convention. You're not a rural area if you have an anime convention. So, you know, there's no such thing as rural radiation oncology. We're called small market radiation oncology for a reason. Now, a substantial percentage of my patients do, in fact, live way out in the sticks, you know, in towns that have no stoplights. And so we do serve a large number of rural patients, but that doesn't mean that me or Simul or anybody else is quote unquote rural.
Yeah, that's so fair. I say rural a lot. That's a fair correction. I mean, we can say we take care of rural patients more often than the other centers may because of their proximity. It's not a choice anybody makes. It's just they're going to come here. You know, they're going to come to you or me. They're not always going to drive to Detroit or what's closest for you. Houston's probably closest to you.
Yeah, Houston.
Yeah. So what do you think? It's like an age-old question in medicine. Like, how do we get people to get there? You know, how do you get a guy like you to go down to Lake Charles, who's never been to Lake Charles, who's Asian American, who I think was single when he moved down to Lake Charles?
Yeah, that's true. You know, so obviously, you know, one of the problems with maldistribution, you know, honestly, is just sort of the personal preferences of the people who go into medicine, right? So me personally, even though I've lived in big cities like Louisville and Indianapolis for many years, I actually always liked smaller towns, you know, growing up somewhere that where you're not always having to, you know, get stuck in traffic and pay money to park and, you know, worry if you're going to get your car towed. It's not that I'm super rural. You know, I wouldn't want to live out in Plocheville and, you know, have no people and just raise some pigs. My personal preference is that small cities like about this size or slightly larger, you know, probably matches my preferences more than, you know, living in Houston or living in Chicago or living in Miami would. And I do very much feel like there's a certain percentage of maldistribution that really is kind of a recruiting issue. And the way that medical schools and the way that residencies select candidates artificially enriches for a very, very certain phenotype or a certain cultural milieu that you could call cosmopolitan or, you know, globalist or whatever you want to call it. Because I had a classmate in residency, Ben Goodman, and he was somebody who grew up in small town Kentucky on a farm. And I think his family still owns that farm. And really was somebody who enjoyed living in a rural area. And I believe he's, you know, back in small town Kentucky practicing now. And basically the whole time that he was in residency, I remember seeing attendings and just random other residents and people basically making fun of him for being a hick. You know, there's no two ways around it. Because he just culturally did not project that cosmopolitan feeling that you expect from a, you know, allopathic MD in the United States. And people really gave him a hard time about it. They also, in one case, because he was very much, you know, a Protestant, you know, devout Christian boy, consulted him to speak with a patient who had biblical questions about their cancer diagnosis. That was very interesting.
Yeah. And it takes also a relatively open mind to go into a situation like that too, because I'm not a very religious person, and you mentioned you're agnostic, but there's a way to connect with Christian people. I'm using Christian because mostly small town American is going to be Christian people, that respects them, that allows you to learn from them. And you know, and faith matters to these folks, to many folks. And, you know, this is a very religious country still.
And absolutely.
Especially in these smaller markets, it's important. And some people are going to have some trouble. You hear the way people talk about religious people or Christian people, and they may not be the, you know, well suited to go to a place like that. But at the same time, for whatever reason, the cultural milieu that's being selected, as you're saying, is people who generally have a distaste for faith-based anything.
Right. I mean, I think in a lot of the big cities and academic centers where you have radiation oncology residencies, if you're somebody who's a very, very, you know, outward-facing, very obvious, you know, practicing conservative Christian, then at the very least, you feel some amount of just, you know, playground teasing. People making fun of you for, you know, being too much of a Jesus freak. And if you open your mouth on the wrong topic, like abortion, you know, you can expect to get piled on and become a villain. And that, you know, that entire aspect is exactly the opposite of what it's like living in a smaller town. You know, living in Lake Charles, where most people are very, very religious, with a mixture of Catholics and Protestants, you know, and practicing at a Catholic hospital. Me being agnostic doesn't come up often, you know, because people, it's not the first thing I'm going to talk about. And I will, you know, pray with people. I will spend moments in silence with people, but I'm not going to identify as something that I'm not. If somebody asks me straight up, you know, about Jesus or about Bible verses, I'm not going to pretend. And I have had in 10 years, maybe two patients that had a serious problem with that. You know, that the moment they learned I did not share their faith, they were very, very offended and wanted to seek another physician.
Yeah,
I think that's two out of thousands.
But that, I mean, that makes some sense. Like, if, I don't know, like if you went to a Middle Eastern country that was predominantly Muslim and you were a Jewish physician, maybe there would be discomfort there. Or if you were a Hindu physician, there might be some discomfort there. I think that. People, this is a big generalization, but people in big cities or liberal-minded think that they're more open-minded, when in fact, you know, when we're the ones going to smaller towns and we become the fish out of water, maybe it's not us that are open-minded. Maybe we have to have our minds opened, that people are different than us and they share values that might be different, not only different than us, but in opposition to our values. But that's neither here nor there. They need our care.
Yeah, and that patient encounter, I mean, I immediately thought of, I've maybe had two people in my career of also thousands of new patients at this point, or maybe 1,000 new patients at this point, that wanted to not see me because I was a man. It was like two patients with breast cancer. It's very, very rare. That's fine. I always tell patients that you should be comfortable with your doctor. And I think it's just going to kind of happen either way. But I just wanted to echo like what you're saying is as a large market city person that grew up in a suburb of Chicago and like kind of lived that whole life and then trained all through academics, I didn't really notice any of this at all until I did a little bit of locums at a rural clinic in Missouri. And really, I'm talking like a total of maybe 3 to 4 weeks over a couple of years. And so not a lot of exposure. But one thing you notice right away is that it's sort of like a real world of medicine that you never see as an academic. And for me, it totally changed the way that I view like all of this research that talks about, you know, quote, rural RADONC, even though, as you just said, most of it's not actually rural. And then, you know, this idea that like of how the problem is going to be fixed, because I genuinely do believe that if you, as I was an academic kind of sitting in a big center in a big city, and you've never been to one of these clinics, like you don't notice a lot of these things, right? You talk about quality, but people don't realize that so much of the quality is impacted. The traditional quality metrics are impacted by the fact that you don't have an interventional radiologist on site every day, because that's something you just kind of take for granted. So to me, what's really cool about this and the message I hope the listeners get is just that it, you know, I think I tweeted this yesterday, I think, or maybe a couple of days ago, it would be super beneficial for everyone to get some firsthand experience working in a clinic like that, because I feel like you just learn a lot in terms of being open-minded. You might not learn all the academic teaching points that everyone wants to, but there's like a lot of life experience that gets taught, I think, by being exposed to those clinics.
Yeah. I mean, well, you know, to go back to Portsmouth for a second, like that job comes up every couple of years. And I'll tell you, I just looked it up. They're starting people at $600,000. There's a $100,000 sign-on. There's like $100,000 or $200,000 in student loan benefits, like 45 days off or something. I forgot, something absurd. And, you know, we hear that there's pressure getting jobs. Why aren't people lining up for that job?
Yeah. And I'll tell you why, because, you know, my parents live there. I've actually been there, you know, and the fact is, it's really, really hard to convince physicians to stay in Portsmouth, Ohio, because the lifestyle there is so completely alien, you know, to what any of us city slickers, even small city slickers, are used to. I mean, you're talking about living in an area that's, you know, so remote. There is no shopping mall. You know, Lake Charles at least has a shopping mall. You go to you know, you go to Portsmouth, Ohio, the only store in town is a Walmart, and you're having to drive about an hour and a half across the West Virginia border to even go shopping, or, you know, to find a restaurant other than the like three little family restaurants that exist in Portsmouth. You're constantly having to make a 2-hour trek to Columbus, Ohio, you know, anytime you need, you know, some work done on your car, right? You know, there's no car dealerships in town. That, you know, there's a lot of quality of life things that living in a city you take for granted, even living in most small cities. But when you start getting to the really, really small, you start getting to the Portsmouth, Ohio and Salinas, Kansas type jobs that are perpetually open. You know, it is now, those are rural radiation oncology. Those are getting dangerously close to having a LINAC in a cornfield. And so it's hard. You know, and there are people out there who grew up in extremely rural locations and would be as happy as a clam, you know, living there and hunting deer and going fishing and, you know, walking through caves. But almost none of those people go to medical school and, you know, go to radiation oncology residency and become board certified in radiation oncology. To me, a large amount of that is selection, and it's not something that you can really overcome with material incentives, you know, because as you said, these jobs pay a crap load and they come with fantastic benefits, but people come in, they interview in the town, and they look at it and they try to imagine themselves living in that town and they can't.
Yeah. So I had a couple opportunities in smaller towns. in my early 30s. I was single and really cool jobs, really interesting jobs. And I mean, the recruiting was fantastic. The dinners, you meet these people that like just, I'm not going to say salt of the earth, but they really like good people, you know. And in my mind, I was like, you know what? My parents, you know, Indian parents are on my ass to get married. How would I find somebody in this town? And that's not even just an Indian woman or Indian man or whatever, but it would be someone who shares my values and what I want to see, what I want to have my life look like in the future. So if it's okay with you, would you mind talking about that going into this small town?
You know, to be fair, that was definitely something I worried about a lot. And I remember when I first came to Lake Charles, you know, I was single and I went on a date at one point with a girl who was very good looking, but she was not only local, she was one of those real, real rural country girls. And, you know, I think she grew up on an alligator farm. And so she was wearing all these alligator teeth and alligator skin things and totally alligator themed. And then, you know, we just started talking and I realized I literally cannot hold a conversation with this person. You know, she wants to talk about alligators and fishing and hunting and, you know, doing all the outdoorsy things in the middle of the swamp. And I want to talk about, you know, culture and politics and maybe some, you know, pop culture or, you know, anime or whatever, video games. And we don't have a single shared interest that we can even hold a conversation about. So that definitely was a concern, you know, when I first came to town. And honestly, I think a big reason why I'm still here is pure luck, because I just, you know, ran into Claire, who's my current wife. We've been, we were dating for maybe 6 or 7 years. We've been married for a little over 4 years. And she happens to be somebody from super, super rural Louisiana, you know, who's just kind of a geek, somebody who reads a whole lot of, you know, fiction and watches anime, plays video games, and is much more culturally aligned with the kind of things that I do. You know, although I still, you know, she'll play Baldur's Gate, but she's not yet playing tabletop Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, I mean, so
there is a lot of cultural fit issues when you're moving to a smaller location.
Yeah, and that's why it's like, it's not that there's no culture there. It's just a culture that's extremely foreign to us.
Right.
And it is rich in its own way, and especially Louisiana. I mean, Louisiana is like a different country. I went to medical school.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, even in Port Huron, again, we're 55 miles from the city or so, and it half the staff was off last week for deer season. And we had, yep. That's it. Like we're not going to not let them take it off. This is something they've done. They've done with their dad, and their dad did with their grandfather. And that's something that they're going to continue to do 50 years from now. And that, you know, we have a healthy respect for that. So, you know, you did meet someone that, and that's good. I interviewed in, I'm not going to say where, just, and so I don't have to out anybody, but I went there, I interviewed, had a great discussion with the people. The person that was leaving was a young woman who went there single and was leaving single. And she's like, mm-hmm. I'm not doing this. I can't do it. I can't make it work. And I interviewed and I really liked it. And I thought the town was good. And I was actually ready to maybe consider it. And they called and said, you know, we're not going to take the chance on you. We want somebody already married.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Yeah, because we don't want to lose another good doc and have to do this all over again. And so I thought that was kind of an interesting experience. And I'm glad, you know, I'm glad it worked out the way it did, because very soon after I met my now wife. And so it was what do you think we could do? I mean, like, I think we've talked about it online various times and people write about it. But what are the real things we can do? Because money isn't enough, right? Like if Portsmouth's offering endless riches, and they change out every 2 years. I mean, what could they truly do to get somebody like one of us to go there?
That's a really good question. You know, I don't know that there is a obvious short-term answer for some place like Portsmouth, Ohio. Because other than, I mean, because people really do kind of go there. They're attracted by the riches. And then once they've made enough money to save it in an investment account, they kind of run away. Because in a way, I think, well, the just from personal experience, the radiation oncologists that work at a very, very low quality of life location, you know, just to make money, it's sort of like the, you know, deep sea fishermen, but with less, you know, physical danger. You go to do something extremely unpleasant and uncomfortable and stay in a place you don't want to stay long enough to save up enough money that you don't have to do that in the future. And I have a hard time imagining how that will change in the short term. I think in the long term, honestly, you probably saw on Twitter, you know, Dr. Glockenflecken, the world's greatest doctor, social media doctor, you know, made some tweet, a series of tweets about how he wanted to start an entire med school where you're banned from doing original research. You can read research, you can critique research, you learn all about statistical analysis of research, but you're not allowed to do any. And while that's halfway tongue in cheek, you know, and I think is a commentary on the inflation of how many publications modern day med students and residents are expected to have, I think there is something very real in that. In general, the kind of person who culturally would enjoy hunting and fishing and going to church is not the kind of person who enjoys, you know, writing grants and publishing retrospective analyses and, you know, doing data farming to get one more first author publication on their CV.
Absolutely. You're right. This is what you alluded to this earlier. We're actively selecting against people that may work in these towns.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like actively, like we're aggressively removing the types of people that would work in those towns from our list of possible candidates.
Yeah. And so, I'm not speaking at all to the kind of people that would work in towns. I don't really know that like specifically, but one thing that's definitely true is that the demographics of who's applying to radiation oncology is definitely changing. So I think this was covered like in Becta's podcast, but you know, the number of U.S. allopathic MDs is kind of dropping. And then the people that are replacing them to keep the numbers stable is an increase in foreign medical grad applicants and then some DOs as well. And again, like you can't speak to what their desires are, but it'll be interesting to me to see if the match statistics change, right? Or is what's going to happen that most people are going to match still? Because I do think there is discrimination against those kinds of applicants in radiation oncology still. There shouldn't be. And so one thing you're saying is to try to broaden who we actually accept. The only other thing I was going to add is like I've been talking with some med students this year, just making some podcasts about the match and things like that from their perspective. And programs don't signal well to support this. I know of one applicant that has a specific career interest in treating, quote, rural patients. What I think what this person means is that they want to work in a smaller center that serves a wide area of patients that may live in small towns. And like among the ones they've applied to, I have a hard time telling them what I think would best support that because I don't know that, you know, these programs signal very well. So there's probably room to improve on both ends of like trying to broaden the applicant pool in general.
No, yeah. Absolutely. And if I can add one more thing, you know, I would say there's a certain mindset in radiation oncology that the two of you have spoken about a lot on this podcast. You know, which is the idea that radiation oncologists are very, very shy about being a cowboy. You know, we feel like we're only comfortable doing the procedures and doing the treatments that we're, you know, ultra, ultra hyper expert in. And that if we're even a little bit uncertain, we feel more comfortable kicking it to someone else, whether it's another rad onc or a totally different specialty, instead of learning to do that procedure or do that practice ourselves. And I think that mindset is very much something that we're trained in from the very moment that we start as a PGY2. It's kind of, for some reason, has become built into the DNA of radiation oncology as a field. And that mindset is absolutely terrible for a small town practice. Because when you're doing a small practice and you don't have a whole lot of consultants, you don't have a lot of specialties to, you know, to help you, a lot of times you get stuck having to do sort of odd tasks and manage odd things. You know, I have patients who get surgery 2.5 hours away and they have a surgeon who follows them and, you know, sees them on their cell phone. But when they wind up with a wound infection on the donor side on their thigh, you know, where they had a flap taken off for their, you know, neck dissection, I'm the one that's like examining that and going like, oh God, that looks infected. And I'm prescribing an antibiotic and then, you know, prescribing a wound care order. And then afterwards I'm calling the surgeon and making the referral to a wound care center. You know, yeah, we often have to step outside of our strict radiation oncology limits in a small town, and you don't do that at a bigger center.
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely have to. We have to do things that we thought we'd never do at times. And it's really interesting. One of the things that we've done here, and it probably happens to you over there, is that we become the primary oncologist and we're the ones setting everything up and seeing the patient before there's tissue and referring them for the biopsy and referring them to all the staging and everything. It's a lot of resource utilization for the clinic, which is not really set up for this necessarily. And they're having to do a ton of coordinated care, and they're having to do a lot of the setting up of things that a larger oncology office typically handles, or a navigator typically handles, but this tiny clinic. Now, you know, I was looking at the map. Portsmouth is an hour and 50 minutes from Columbus. My sister went to Ohio State. You know, we're from Michigan. It was horrendous. We disowned her. I'm just kidding.
The Ohio State.
So, you know, when I'm going this weekend, I like visiting Columbus. There's a lot to do. If I was able to work Monday, Wednesday, Friday in person, live in Columbus, and Tuesday, Thursday, I'm working from home, I may consider that.
I agree. Yeah. And I actually, you know, wrote a little spiel about this for, you know, just preparing for today, because I think a lot of people have been talking about this idea of supervision and what should and what shouldn't count as supervision in radiation oncology. I absolutely believe, you know, that we need to be there in person for OTVs. You know, this idea that some people have had that we're somehow going to do OTVs as telemedicine, again, the clinics that are going to be most tempted financially and practically to run without any MDs and just therapists and nurses are going to be places like Portsmouth, you know, or even here, Lake Charles or Lake Huron or whatever, where the patients are going to need somebody to dress a wound and are going to need somebody to listen to their lungs and to do, you know, general purpose doctoring, which you can't do over the phone. And so absolutely, you know, my belief is that 100% OTVs have to be in person. But there's no reason, if you have a competent team of therapists and LINAC and all the patients are setting up reasonably well, you know, there's no reason that you shouldn't be able to do offline review, you know, from anywhere. You might still want to be there in person for the, you know, first day, whether you're doing a separate VSIM or whether it's just a new start, you know, you do the VSIM and the first treatment at the same time. You probably want to be there in person so that if there is some show-stopping issue, you know, whether it's a, you know, couch collision or the patient not setting up well or whatever it is, you want to be there. You want to have the ability to lay eyes and lay hands on the patient. But for your daily treatments, yeah, if we had the ability to supervise remotely, I think there would be many clinics like Portsmouth that could have a radiation oncologist there 3 days a week, like you said, and then living, you know, in Columbus in a major city the rest of the time. I think that would probably be a much higher quality of life.
So, I mean, that from the top, from leadership standpoint, they seem to think that changing out a doctor every 2 years because you got to maintain this presence issue and then your family doesn't like Portsmouth is better for the patients of Portsmouth, Ohio, than to have somebody on site 3 days a week that gets to live a metropolitan life. And I push back on that. I mean, I think having a long-term doctor who's on site a little bit less, but generates the relationships with the patients and the referrings is serving this community so much better. And those 3 days are going to be 12-hour days. You know, this is not
busy, busy days.
These are busy days, and these are going, you know, 4 hours in the car. And this is, you know, you're going to be earning your money, even though it's 3 days. Oh. Like, this idea that like work from home is not real work. Yeah, it can be that way, but if you put 16 telemed follow-ups, you know, for your breast prostate on your day, you're going through a lot of stuff. You're talking to a lot of people. It can be very busy and harrowing. And I don't see that as lesser work.
Yeah. And now that I've been here for 10 years, I think I've I've realized, you know, something that I wouldn't have known, you know, 6 years ago, which is just how much value continuity brings. If you look at average tenure of physicians in smaller towns versus big cities, you'll see a lot more 30-year, you know, 40-year lifelong practices in small towns than in big places. Part of that is because we're of maldistribution and there's nobody that's jockeying to take our job. But another part of that is that once you've sunk your roots in, and once you have everybody's phone numbers on your phone, and you've met them and you've hung out with them and you've probably hung out with their kids or with their dads, you know, you suddenly become twice as valuable of a physician as you were when you first got there, even if your competence and scope of practice haven't improved. Because just being that, you know, member of the community who has roots in the surrounding, you know, communities around you, and can just pick up a phone and get stuff done is so, so valuable. And that only happens because I've been here for enough years that people know my name and they recognize me and they're willing to talk to me. That's not something you get the first year that you're there. And so this idea that we can keep on rotating mercenary physicians, you know, out like they're deep sea fishermen, you know, in The Deadliest Catch, doesn't really work, you know, for physicians.
I can hear Joint Lou like cheering all the way from California to what you're saying. I know that all of our small market physician champions would kind of agree with everything you're saying. It's really, really important. My frustration, sorry, I stumbled to interrupt you, but mine was just that I don't think anyone's having this conversation at the level that you both are, right? This is not like when people are arguing about this on Twitter, you can tell that they're thinking of this sort of like vague thing about how a doctor being present helps improve treatment or whatever for unclear reasons. But no one's talking about the other side of the conversation, which is what you just said. And there's so much intangible value there.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, I think that I forget if it was your podcast or one of the other podcasts where talking about complex systems, you know, people thinking that this is a simple system that's like the, you know, gas pedal on a car. You either have to go faster or you go slower, and that's how we're going to solve all these supply issues. It's totally ridiculous because it doesn't, like we've seen with Portsmouth, Ohio, it doesn't matter how hard you press, you know, the gas. If people don't want to practice there, then they'll take the money, they'll take the gas, and then they'll leave. And if you try to keep pressing the gas so hard, you know, you oversupply so much that people are forced to work in places they don't want to work. Well, you've just lowered everybody's quality of life to the lowest possible denominator.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to the system aspect to it. Jordan Johnson, a consultant, you know, has that price transparency tool. And so I did a little search of our region. And not only are we in a poorer area, but we get half per fraction for IMRT than Beaumont and Ford. And so not only are we resource strapped and far away from everything we need, but we're also getting paid less for the same services. Now, granted, we can make the argument that Prime Health needs to contract better, like my hospital needs to contract better. But at the same time, like, you know, this is clear, the payers know what they're paying. They know what they're paying everybody. And if they were in it to lower costs, which I don't believe insurance companies actually are in it to do, they would want more like us and they would try to route patients to us rather than, you know, continually pushing to the higher charging centers that may or may not be better. I mean, there's some cases where they are. Like, I'm not going to pretend that I can do everything. And I'm sure you feel that way too. There's probably, 2-3% of what comes in the door that we would be cured
right out the door. Yeah,
just they're not turned out. Yeah, and I mean, we have to be very, very conscious of that. What other resources or help do you think we could request? What are things like supervision changes? I think those are on the horizon. I think we're going to win that one.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the problems that, you know, really, really kind of chaps me is just how much of a double standard that we see when it comes to dealing with prior authorizations and a lot of these insurance, you know, just administrative hassles. When, you know, when I see a lot of my patients and they're treated by a surgeon at MD Anderson, and they may or may not have their medical oncologist in MD Anderson, and then we're seeing them, we're doing some sort of radiation course locally, it always blows my mind the difference in our ability to both prescribe drugs and get scans, you know, labs, genetic testing, and so on, compared to MD Anderson. You know, every single PSMA PET that we order in Lake Charles, whether I'm ordering it or a local medical oncologist is ordering it, is a knockdown, drag out fight of prior auth on the web and then prior auth with peer reviews and sometimes an appeal. And I think in the ever since PSMA was, you know, first approved by Medicare, what is it, like 5 years ago, I think I've had two PSMAs approved on non-metastatic patients. Yeah, even though the insurance companies send us these lovely rubrics and guidelines saying, oh, anybody with Gleason 4+4 or higher, you know, in theory, you could order one. We order them. We go through the process. They fight tooth and nail. They review records. And in the end, something gets, they find some reason to deny it.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have a prior auth department. I got.
We don't. It's me, my nurse, and my receptionist using our own personal time. And we cry because in many of these cases, we feel like it would benefit the patient. You know, if they have a 50% nomogram calculated risk of having positive lymph nodes, we want that PSMA. You know, the regular CT isn't going to see those lymph nodes. But, you know, and speaking with many of my colleagues that are also in smaller towns, almost everybody has this problem. You know, the patient meets the guidelines. They may even meet the guidelines the insurance company itself, you know, emailed to you. And yet somehow the insurance company doesn't approve the scan. Meanwhile, you send exactly the same patient with exactly the same, you know, clinical picture, you know, down to MD Anderson, and they've somehow gotten a PSMA by the time the patient's walked in the door. And it's the same for drugs, too. I mean, I have had patients where in between the patient, the navigator, and my nurse, they are spending hours and hours and hours on the phone with multiple entities to get approved for a totally boring standard of care drug, whether that's Lupron injections. You know, our medical oncologist has experienced this with Zoloda. Incredibly boring routine things. They waste so much time and the insurance company fights tooth and nail. Meanwhile, I have patients who, you know, go across the state lines to Houston, and they come back with all these highly advanced, you know, monoclonal antibodies, and, you know, they don't ever get Lupron. They're all on, you know, Relugolix and all of these super, super fancy high dollar value drugs. Somehow MD Anderson gets them all approved. And I have a strong suspicion of how that somehow is, you know. We all heard, you know, about 3 or 4 years ago about the famous, you know, SQ lawsuit and jury settlement, where MD Anderson was awarded a $200 million verdict against UnitedHealth because UnitedHealth or one of their subsidiaries declined proton beam therapy, you know, for a non-small cell lung cancer. You know, is there any evidence that protons improve overall survival in unresectable lung cancer? No. And there definitely wasn't any in 2015 when the patient was treated. But because MD Anderson has a big name and because they have a legal team that's, you know, on the same tier as Amazon or Disney, you know, they were able to win that lawsuit and bully the insurer. And now the insurers are so scared, they approve all sorts of things, you know, just check mark, you know, box clicking, you know, what do you call it? Rubber stamping, you know, just because it came from MD Anderson. And right, we don't get that resource in small towns.
Right. I mean, there's centers that are hiring companies to do this for them, that like they have a line item to pay somebody to help them through prior auth, which is wild because, you know, I deal with it as a provider. I deal with it on the other end as a prior auth person. You know, makes me a villain to some people, but, you know, I'm trying to help make it a little bit better for us out there. I want to talk about a little bit about peer review, because that's one of the things that's been tough for me. This is my first solo job. Mm-hmm. And I I'm terrified about errors and terrified about causing a problem in a patient because I didn't do right by a patient, because I missed something, because that can happen. We're human beings. And I call my friends and we Zoom and they look at cases with me. But when we get busy, there's not anything formal. Curious, what do you do? How do you think, like a solo doc that's not part of a network or institution like Ochsner, what do we do?
I wish I knew. You know, for the first 6 years that I was here, we were not yet part of Ochsner. So I was really, you know, basically solo under the greater umbrella of Christus. But, you know, the Christus Radonks were all just assorted Radonks here and there, you know, without really any relationship between us. So I had tried reaching out to some of the other Radonks in Louisiana, and we just never could really make things work. I mean, in between issues with, you know, patient confidentiality and having to sign HIPAA agreements and BAAs between your two different centers, you know, it gets really tricky. And then there's just the technical aspect, which is you think that it should be easy to just Zoom or, you know, Microsoft Teams someone and review their plan, but it's not always, you know, that easy. Everybody's TPS is different from someone else's TPS. The way that you actually review plans, you know, what screen you go to view your dose constraint sheet versus what the those DVHs and the dose points actually look like. It's different for every system. And if you're not familiar with it, you might be peer reviewing with somebody else, and yet they're not really able to get a good sense of how good or how bad your plan is.
Varian has that peer review option if you're a Varian customer, but it's $40 or $50 a case.
Jeez. Okay. I did not know that. We haven't tried, you know,
it anonymizes it and makes it, you know, easy to view, and you can peer review across, you know, virtually. And we can't do that. Like, I'm not paying out of my pocket. And my hospital's not going to pay for that. Yet it's considered absolutely necessary for accreditation. You're a bad monster if you don't do peer review, which, you know, partially part of me agrees with that. I feel like people should look at my cases as many as they can. But, you know, the national organization, the society, is pushing for this rocker plan, which is forcing accreditation. And all those require peer review. And I'm not saying we shouldn't do peer review, but we're putting undue pressure on people who are already facing many challenges.
Yeah. And, you know, let me talk about accreditation, because we don't have it. We've, over the years, looked at it several times, you know, looked at the costs, looked at the administrative burden, you know, of different accreditations. You know, you have your APEX versus your ACR versus whatever. And honestly, we just kind of came to the conclusion that, you know, it really wasn't worth the squeeze. So we in Lake Charles, you know, are not formally accredited as a Radonk program, as opposed to, say, Baton Rouge or, you know, New Orleans, who obviously are. And accreditation, and in general, I mean, not just talking about radiation oncology accreditation, but your COC accreditation for your cancer program as a whole, and your accreditation for your diagnostic radiology services, mammography, this, that, and the other, I feel like it's something that's become a heavier and heavier lift over time. You know, obviously, as the only Radonk, you're kind of forced to be part of the cancer committee and part of a lot of these, you know, administrative chores that are related to getting your certificates and accreditations. And it just feels like every year the accreditations require, you know, more work and more money. And you're often paying outside consultants to do things like tumor registry and do a lot of data management. And do we really, as a society, you know, as the United States of America, do we really get the value, you know, out of spending so much money, so much manpower on a whole bunch of these accreditations? You know, how much do we really get out of it? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been at centers that are ACR certified, and last year was the first year I started thinking of releasing us from that. I don't think we're going to, but I think it is very burdensome. And what ACR, I can't speak for APEX or ECRO, but they are not doing any clinical radiation oncology peer review or quality assessment. Zero. You can give 60 gray and 60 fractions to the breast to an early stage breast cancer. And if all your paperwork's correct and your physics paperwork is correct, that case will be reviewed as fine. There's no guidelines for that kind of stuff. And, you know, I know a lot of people feel that heavy-handed peer review has its own problems, but no guardrails at all. And we're paying $12,000. You know, I do PA, so I see a lot of shenanigans, and I oftentimes Google the center and we'll see that they're ACRO certified, ACR certified, or APEX certified. And yet there is no guardrail from those organizations, because clearly these people are egregiously inappropriate. We're not talking difference in opinion. We're talking about, you know, insane things. And I don't know that we should continue to pay the $12,000 a year, whatever the number is. I mean, I don't pay it. Of course, the hospital pays it. But it's not just the money. It's the time. We lose about 20, right, 30 hours of labor, more maybe, yeah, with the physics team.
You may pay $12,000 directly to the accreditor, but when you look at the number of hours that you pay employees who have to spend their time on accreditation instead of doing useful tasks, you know, you could be spending $40,000 or $50,000 on accreditation.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's about time for us to rethink it again. I you know, we're good for next few years, but I think it's something that's going to come up. Yeah. David, there's so much more to talk about, but we're running out of time.
I know. So
to set up a part two, I'm sure. This is great. I'm so glad we got a chance to talk. Any last thoughts?
Well, this was a lot of fun for me too, man. This hour really flew by. So I'm absolutely willing to join you on another day. And I wish you a happy Thanksgiving, and wish the audience a happy Thanksgiving. I don't know if this is coming out before Thanksgiving.
I'm hoping to get it out, but we'll edit this out if it doesn't get on there. But yeah, have a great holiday, and we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening. If you liked our show, please subscribe and leave us a rating. Also, head to photonmedia.org and check out the rest of our content. We hope you're having a great day and look forward to seeing you again soon.